It is now. Good morning. I'd like to open the House Interim Committee on Business and Labor. Happy New Year. It is January 13th, and we have an informational meeting today. We will be discussing minimum wage first. And the order of the people coming up will be a little bit different than is on the agenda. And then we also have a short presentation on a couple of the work groups, which will relate to the committee bills will be introducing injured workers' right to seek medical services, providers of their choice, and brewery license privileges. And with that, do you have anything to add, Jan?
I don't. Thank you.
So with that, I'll go ahead and open the informational meeting, and we'll start out with the minimum wage discussion. And I thought we'd have up first Nick Belichick. I can never say his name correctly, but I try every time. And he's the Employment Department economist. And I thought he could give us a little bit of background before we get started. And committee members, we have had some of you have attended an ongoing work group which finished up before Christmas with Senator Dembro and other legislators, a lot of stakeholders. Since our last hearing on a minimum wage bill last session, we continued a work group, continued discussion, hearing from economists and industries and labor representatives, and having a good discussion about the pros and cons of minimum wages. So, welcome, Nick. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Nick, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Nick Belichick. I'm the state employment economist for the research division of the Oregon Employment Department. And the Employment Department has received a lot of requests related to data for minimum wage jobs in Oregon over the last year. Not surprisingly, what I'd like to do today is sort of go over a lot of the common questions we're receiving and show what data we have and what the data is telling us. I should be able to get this done within 15 minutes and get out of your way. Let the other conversations continue. For starters, I'd like to talk about two of the wage trends that we see happening in Oregon right now. The first is the short-term wage trends, and then the long-term wage trends, and these should help cue up the discussion of minimum wages. So, the first is Oregon's average hourly wage adjusted for inflation. That has increased quite a bit over the last year. We're seeing increases in the average hourly wage of about 4% over the last year. And since there's very little measurable inflation, these have turned into real wage gains for workers on average. This is partly due to lower unemployment rate and the sign of a tightening labor market. And that's what we'd expect to see during an economic recovery. You can see how average wages were pretty stagnant, adjusted for inflation for a few years, but they've started rising over the last year. Keep in mind that this is a short-term graph. I only have data here going back to 2007. And averages don't necessarily reflect what most workers are earning. They're also influenced by higher wage earners, which bring up the average. So I'd like to also show the longer-term perspective of wages. This graph shows median wages, that's the middle line, the median earnings of a worker in Oregon who's worked all four quarters throughout the year, so they have pretty stable work. Adjusted for inflation, that hasn't really increased at all over the last 25 years.
Wow.
the lowest 10th percentile of earners hasn't increased much either over the last 25 years. But we have seen quite strong wage gains among the 90th percentile, the highest wage earners in the group. That's the group that's seen the most wage gains over the last 25 years, adjusted for inflation.
And they haven't gotten a raise in 6 years.
This graph shows Oregon's minimum wage, also adjusted for inflation. That's the green line. That's the green line on top. And the U.S. minimum wage, adjusted for inflation, is the red line below. You can see how about 2004, when Oregon started adjusting the minimum wage for inflation, that line flattens out and it maintains the purchasing power of a minimum wage worker. But the U.S. minimum wage has this pattern of increasing a lot, and then the increase is eroded due to inflation over time, and then it increases again and it's eroded over time. So the U.S. minimum wage ends up being lower than what it was, say, in the late 70s. Oregon's minimum wage is about the same as it was in the late 70s after adjusting for inflation. Also, maybe coincidentally, Oregon's minimum wage throughout that period of the last 15 years has been about half of what the median wage in Oregon is. So I've been asked about that, looked into it, and it's Oregon's minimum wage is consistently about 50% of what the median wage is in Oregon. Median wage right now is about $18 per hour. So looking at minimum wage across the nation, last year, if I were talking about this, I would have said Oregon had the second highest minimum wage in the nation. Well, Oregon's minimum wage didn't increase in 2016 because there wasn't enough inflation, but a lot of states increased their minimum wage, and so Oregon is now has the eighth highest minimum wage, the ninth highest if we count Washington, D.C. as a state. So for the longest time, I've been saying Oregon's had the second highest minimum wage behind Washington, but that's no longer the case.
How many years were we the highest or second highest?
Chair Holvey, Representative Kennemer, at least the last 10 years.
That's what I thought. Yeah. Thank you. Excuse me.
Now, we don't have a lot of demographic data about minimum wage earners in Oregon, so we have to fall back on national estimates based on surveys of households. There aren't enough households in Oregon to really get good demographic data for this. But looking at who works minimum wage jobs nationally, most minimum wage workers are women, about 2 out of 3, 63%, and they tend to be young. The median wage is 25, so half of minimum wage workers are under 25 years old. By comparison, about 47% of the overall U.S. workforce consists of women, and the median wage of the overall U.S. workforce is 42 years.
So it looks like we have to wait until we're 70 before we even out with the men. Is that what the deal is?
Was that a question?
That was just a comment. You do not have to answer that.
Actually, that was an ageist remark, and it was promulgated by Joe.
Yes, that was just a comment. No answer.
Let's allow him to keep going, please. He's having a hard enough time with his electronics.
Most minimum wage workers do not have a college degree.
You might make that comment later.
Yeah, that ties in with also most minimum wage workers being relatively young. Minimum wage workers tend to be part-time workers. So 65% of minimum wage workers work part-time. And nationally, there isn't a lot of difference by race and ethnicity in terms of who works minimum wage jobs compared to who works all jobs. Now we can use data specific to Oregon to talk about minimum wage jobs. We've moved slightly from workers as in the people to jobs as the employer-employee connections. And a lot of this information will, or all this information will be based on data that the Oregon Employment Department gathers from employers while they're paying their unemployment insurance tax or through special surveys. About 5% of the jobs in Oregon are minimum wage or less. That's about 100,000 jobs. The share of minimum wage jobs has consistently been about 5% over the last 15 years. It's ranged from 4 to 6% of the overall economy. When we start looking at jobs that pay slightly above minimum wage, if we go up to $13.49, that adds 518,000 jobs, about 28% of the overall workforce. And if we go up to $14.99, that adds 119,000 jobs, about 6% of the workforce. So overall, if we're looking at jobs that pay less than $15 an hour, that's 39% of all jobs in Oregon.
Okay.
And that varies by industry. So this graph shows the percentage of jobs at those cutoffs per industry. Roughly two-thirds of minimum wage jobs are in the leisure and hospitality, which includes restaurants, retail trade, and natural resources. So the three industries on top are about two-thirds of all minimum wage jobs, about 26% of overall jobs in the economy. So the job numbers here are based on workers plus their tips, as reported to us by employers that when they pay their unemployment insurance tax. Looking instead by industry but by occupation, it's not too surprising that many of the occupations that have a lot of jobs paying minimum wage are the occupations that you'd expect to find in restaurants and stores. So fast food workers, waitresses, retail salespersons, etc. Looking at minimum wage jobs by the size of business, businesses with fewer than 50 employers, so I'm taking the top four categories there and combining them, they employ 43% of all minimum wage jobs, about 33% of all jobs. So businesses with fewer than 50 employers have a larger share of minimum wage jobs than their share of the overall economy. So it's not a big difference, but minimum wage jobs are slightly more concentrated in small businesses. Businesses with 500 jobs or more, the bottom row there, is a smaller share, but there's a lot of jobs in that category, so that accounts to 22,000 jobs. There's still a lot of jobs even though it's a small band.
Nick, can you go back to that for just a second? So you were comparing the under 5 employees to the 500 or more employees, and the graphs look pretty close to the same. Did you comment on the amount of workers in each of those two categories?
Representative Holvey, I don't have the numbers in front of me. In trying to answer the question as in like small employees, I pulled the numbers for 50 jobs or less, so I combined the top four categories, and that's 43% of all minimum wage jobs. I have the number back in the office for the number at 5 or less, and I can send that to the committee.
Just curious.
Yes.
Go ahead. Send it.
Representative Fagan.
Oh, question, Representative Fagan.
This is, I think, a question I know the answer to, but just for sake of clarity, when you talk about small businesses, the definition of that is essentially just by number of employees they have, not anything to do with revenue. So, for example, a law firm with 4 employees, but you know, several million dollars in a year in revenue is still a small business by this definition. So it's not a revenue at all. It's just the number of employees they have is the only measurement of what's a small business. Is that right?
Chair Holvey and Representative Fagan, this is just by the number of employees they have in Oregon. So yeah, it doesn't take any account revenue or anything like that. And my last slide shows the distribution of minimum wage jobs around the state. The darker shaded counties have a higher percentage of their economy paying minimum wage. So Malheur County, for example, has the highest share at 11% of jobs pay minimum wage. And that translates into 1,500 jobs or so. Where Multnomah County has less than 4% of its jobs paying minimum wage, but there's a lot more jobs in Multnomah County, so that translates into over 19,000 jobs. And so that's all my prepared remarks for today.
Thank you. That's a good primer for us for the rest of the conversation. Thank you, Nick.
Thank you.
Up next, I'm going to have Andrea Miller. And Justin. Good morning.
Good morning.
Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good morning, everybody, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Andrea Miller. I'm the executive director of CAUSA, which is an organization that has advocated on behalf of Latino families and immigrants in Oregon for over 20 years now. And, you know, in the conversation about the minimum wage, we always like to start with the daily reality that low-wage workers face here. We all know that the minimum wage is $9.25 an hour, and that's under $20,000 a year, which we know is not enough to afford the basics like housing, food, trips to the doctor. It's really not enough to live on. And as some of the data supported, we aren't talking necessarily just about entry-level jobs or people starting out in their careers. We're talking about family people, moms and dads. They work in our crops, harvesting our food. They take care of our sick and elderly. They keep our airports running. We're really talking about a wide variety of workers here. They're the face of our small businesses. And we strongly believe that raising the wage is one of the best ways to lift these folks out of poverty and on a path to self-sufficiency. When we think about who these workers are, and thank you, Nick, for that good information, I want to add to that by saying that historically underrepresented communities continue to be left behind as low-wage workers, and increasing costs are dragging families down. So when you look at who, for example, is a low-wage worker in Oregon, approximately two-thirds are women, and many of them are the primary breadwinners of their family. Some of them are single moms. People of color make up about 42% of low-wage workers nationally, but constitute only 32% of the U.S. workforce, so there's some disproportionate impact there. And then when you look specifically at Oregon, one-fifth are people of color, 45% are Latino. Latinos only make up 12% of our state, for example. 50% are African American. So you really do see a disproportionate impact of low wages on people of color in our state. But overall, when you look at the impact on all Oregonians, over 500,000 would benefit if we increased the wage floor to $13.50 an hour, which is what I'm here to advocate for, and which is the lowest wage that we've determined that is necessary to provide a basic standard of living for folks living in Oregon, even in the most rural counties. But we also know and we also acknowledge that $13.50 isn't enough for places like Portland. Clearly, we have an affordable housing crisis there. Eugene also. And we also recognize the cost of living is different in places like Klamath Falls, in places like Ontario, and that they face different realities than Portland does. And so that's one of the reasons why we think it's so important that we restore power to local cities to determine if they need a higher wage than the statewide floor. Ultimately, we know that based off of all the stories we've heard, and we'll hear more tomorrow, that Oregonians and working families really want to be able to pay for their own rent, for their own food, without having to rely on public benefits. And that when working families aren't able to pay their bills, it really does hurt all of us, because really, who is paying for those public benefits? It's the taxpayers. and our economy suffers. And we also recognize that we believe it would be a benefit for businesses by adding millions of dollars into our local economy. More money in people's pockets means that they're paying more, that they're spending more at local businesses as well, and that these positive impacts will ripple throughout our local communities and continue the economic growth that we're on. And lastly, you know, I want to end with, you know, we believe that every worker deserves and is worth it to be able to afford food, shelter, and clothing, regardless of where they work, whether it's the fields, whether it's in the factories, whether it's in the kitchen or the fast food places. Everybody should be able to pay for the basics on their own. So thank you for the opportunity to say that we would like to see the wage floor increase to $13.50 and restoring some kind of recognition for regional differences and restoring power to local communities to increase it beyond that. Thank you.
Thank you. I was wondering if you could tell the committee just briefly describe the ballot measure that you're speaking on behalf of.
Great. Yeah, it is really simple. It is those two things. The ballot measure the initiative petition that we are moving forward and collecting signatures on includes increasing the minimum wage to $13.50 over a period of 3 years. A phase-in for us is important so that businesses have some certainty and can plan for $13.50 in addition to lifting preemption. It includes both of those things.
And what are the steps in the 3 years?
That's a great question, which I can get back to. I haven't memorized it.
Okay, that's fine.
Oh, no,
I think we have it. So.
Yeah,
thank you, Chair Holden. Andrea, you mentioned kind of interchangeable low wage and minimum wage. When you refer to low wage, are you referring just to minimum wage?
No, that's a great question. When we look at low wage workers, we're looking at $12.50 and below. There's different studies that define low wage workers as differently. But that's in some cases we also look at, well, who's earning less than $13.50 as well, because ultimately that's our goal, and we want to count it, like when you saw the state statistics, those earning less than $13.50 really were 500,000. That's what that was based off of. But okay. Really great question. Thanks.
And follow up. And then when you talk about them being moms and dads versus young people, do you have those numbers as far as how many of those low-wage earners are parents, you know, trying to provide for a family, or just younger people still living at home working in high school or college jobs?
I don't have the numbers on me right now. I know prior testimonies did include that, and we'd be happy to provide that for you.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So we just fill in that gap. It looks like the incremental increase in 2017 would go to $11, 2018 to $12.25, and then in 2019 go to $13.50.
Thank you.
On that proposal. All right, thank you.
Mr. Chair, is that related then to LC 258?
It's like 5%.
Very, 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 very similar.
Just trying to get the picture. Thank you.
We'll get to that.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Chair Hovey, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to be here. My name is Justin Norton-Kurtzen. I'm the campaign manager for the Oregonians for 15 ballot measure. I'm here to talk about that ballot measure and advocate on behalf of a $15 minimum wage for the state of Oregon. I guess just to start with sort of the questions about the ballot measure specifically. Like the $13.50 ballot measure, it's a three-year phase-in. It will move to $11.50 in January 2017, and then up to $13.25 in January of 2018. And then finally up to 15 in January of 2019. And then for calendar years after 2019, it remains indexed to inflation and adjusts annually as provided by current law. We're pushing about 40,000 signatures collected so far. We expect that by the end of the session, we'll be over 50 or 60,000. So we're well on track to having enough signatures collected by July to put this on the ballot. And just to talk about the idea of a $15 minimum wage a little bit, numerous studies, as I've been here and talked about before, show that $15 an hour really is a bare minimum for people here in the state of Oregon, particularly single parents, but also individuals without dependents as well. According to the Alliance for a Just Society's running study, the wage gap study, even a single person with no dependents in Oregon needs at least about $16 per hour in order to be self-sufficient and adequately provide for themselves. According to a 2014 Oregon Department of Human Services study that was conducted by Oregon State University, the hourly wage needed for a single parent with one child to afford fair market rate small home-based child care without being cost burdened is at least $15 per hour in all but four counties in the state of Oregon. So this issue is important because what we're talking about here is not just economics, right? It's not just numbers on a spreadsheet that are need to be mitigated or reduced. This isn't just a game of you know, seeing what kind of deal we can make with the people who are sitting on the other side of a negotiating table, right? We're talking about real lives and families and their health and their welfare. We're talking about the strength of our local communities. We're also talking about, as Andrea discussed, we're talking about racial and gender equity and justice. Right, 60% of women in the state of Oregon work minimum wage jobs. Like Andrea said, 50% of black workers, 45% of Latino workers work in low-wage industries. So $15 minimum wage isn't just about a raise for fast food workers or home care workers or janitors or child care workers or social service workers or any of the other workers who earn less than $15 per hour here in the state of Oregon. It's also about recognizing that women, people of color, transgendered people, other populations here in the state have been systematically disenfranchised. It's about recognizing that these populations are disproportionately overrepresented among our low-wage workforce here in Oregon and actually doing something about it that's bold, like passing a statewide $15 minimum wage, something that will make Oregon a real leader on issues not only like the minimum wage, but on the issues of racial and gender equity, ending pay gaps, and ensuring all Oregonians really have the promise of equal opportunity and equity for all. So huge victories for 15 are already being won throughout the state of Oregon. Over 20,000 home care workers throughout our state won a $15 minimum wage. Full-time city workers and contract workers in Portland, thousands of workers in Multnomah County, all of the employees for the city of Milwaukee. And with more than half of likely voters in Oregon already polling in favor of 15 in numerous polls conducted throughout the state, a statewide $15 minimum wage really is inevitable. It's a grassroots movement, and it isn't just going to go away because any old deal is struck in the state legislature. But if there is going to be a deal, then it needs to at least have $15 per hour for the most expensive parts of the state, like Multnomah County, Clackamas County, Washington County. Or it needs to at least include the repeal of the anti-worker, ALEC-inspired minimum wage preemption law that prevents cities and counties where the cost of living is more expensive from going higher. If at least one or both of these basic pieces can't be accomplished this session, then we'll do everything we can to build the support needed to put IP 41 on the ballot and win. Thanks.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Question. Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your studies, you said there's numerous studies that show bare minimum $15. Have you done studies to see what this would do to the economy and what kind of an impact it would have on jobs?
Personally, our organization has not, but the Oregon Center for Public Policy has done a study particularly on large minimum wage increases in Oregon in the past. In the late 80s, the minimum wage was increased by a similar amount, about 42% over 2 years, and this is about 60% over 3 years, so it's proportionally similar in size. And then back in the 70s, Oregon state minimum wage was increased by 80% over 4 years. And in both cases, the state's economy and working people did well in the years and the decade afterwards.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate both of you coming down and giving us a primer on the initiatives, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Up next, go to my cheat sheet here. I've got Betsy Earls and Molly McGarger. I hope I said that right. Good morning.
Good
Good morning,
introduce
Mr.
yourself
Chair,
for the record.
Members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries. Thank you so much for the opportunity to address you today on minimum wage. I know we've talked about this in the past, and we'll probably be talking about it in the future, but we do appreciate the opportunity today during your legislative days. AOI represents, as you know, probably 1,500 businesses across the state of Oregon, and those businesses represent about 200,000 jobs to workers across the state. AOI represents workers and employers, large and small, and our membership represents is approximately the same as the demographic of size of businesses across the state. In other words, AOI is not a large business association necessarily. We have a small percentage of large employers, and most of our base is made up of smaller 25 and unders. AOI supports Oregon's current minimum wage structure, which, as you know, indexes the formerly second highest in the nation wage to the CPI. Now I understand we're somewhere between 8 and 10. Our member businesses are very concerned that if we increase the state minimum wage further, we will have a negative impact on economic expansion and job growth. And that's just starting to recover in Oregon, and that kind of negative impact is not going to benefit our workers or our employers. We know that although Oregon's minimum wage is quite high relative to the nation, this hasn't translated to economic gains for Oregon workers relative to those in the rest of the country. Since 2002, when voters passed Measure 25, which increased the minimum wage and indexed it to the CPI, our unemployment rate has consistently exceeded the federal unemployment rate, and Oregon's poverty rate has exceeded the national average. By the same token, though, our family wage jobs aren't growing fast enough to support our families. No family should have to live on a minimum wage, whatever that minimum wage is. But increasing the minimum wage alone is not going to be the answer. Rather, our policymakers, legislators, should be looking at ways to expand the economy and find ways for Oregonians to flourish. We would prefer to see policies that not require businesses necessarily to pay more at a flat minimum wage, but cause conditions, economic conditions, that would require employers, that would cause employers to have to pay more in order to get workers to work for them. I think many of the bills that we saw last session mandated certain terms of conditions of employment that were responses to the economic crisis that we have just been through. Obviously, when the economy sinks, businesses do the best that they can to stay afloat. And unfortunately, that sometimes has meant in the past cutting labor costs, either by laying people off or restricting benefits and pay. But as I mentioned, I think we've all seen that the economy is starting to recover. And I would suggest that a better strategy for taking advantage of that fact is to seek policy opportunities that will grow the economy and family wage jobs. I think I'll leave it there, except that you had asked, Mr. Chair, for comments, particularly on the two proposals before you right now. You know, I think you get the idea about what we think about the flat increase. There is also before you the regional proposal. And what I would say to that is, in particular for businesses that have locations across the state, that will create a lot of confusion and difficulty, especially when you have workers that can work in more than one location. It's turned out to be very difficult for our employers in other states that have a regional wage to have employees going back and forth between locations and organizing, keeping track of those pay rates and keeping track of employees who are obviously much less inclined to work in the locations that have the lower wage rate. So we, at this point, continue to support preemption and would oppose lifting of any preemption and also any differential in wage rates across the state and region, different regions.
Representative Nose.
Betsy, in our work group that we had over the fall, we heard from a lot of economists and people that the growth in Oregon's sort of where jobs are growing, they're growing in the more low-wage sector. Now, maybe that'll change as things get better in the economy, but the growth has been in more in occupations that pay a lower wage historically. I understand you guys are opposed to raising the minimum wage, and you want us to do other things to grow the economy. I'm curious what policy ideas you would suggest that we look at to grow jobs in the middle wage sector?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, at the moment, I don't have a series of policy recommendations for you to grow jobs in the economy. What I would suggest is that we implement policies that don't discourage employers from opening businesses or running businesses in this state or expanding the number of jobs, especially at that lower entry level.
One follow-up, if I may.
Follow-up.
All right. So I guess I believe, and I'm curious if what your organization thinks about this, is what do we think that people who get an increase in their minimum wage are going to do with the money that they get, the increase? So we raise the minimum wage to $11 an hour. What's going to happen with that money that those people get?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what I would say to that is that if you raise the minimum wage, if you get a wage increase to $11 an hour as part of a minimum wage increase, you won't be the only person getting that wage increase. The people that you pay for services that you use, including daycare, for example, are also going to be getting that same wage increase. It's going to increase the costs that you pay as a wage earner, all the way from your groceries to your daycare. So I don't know that kind of across-the-board increase is going to benefit a worker in particular. I don't think they're going to run off and waste their money, if that's what you're asking.
One more follow-up. You don't think they'll spend it in the businesses that you represent? You don't think they'll spend the increased earnings that they get in the stores, on the services, in the places that your organization represents?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I absolutely think that they will spend it in the businesses that I represent, and those are the same businesses that will be paying the higher wage in the first place and will have to pass it along in their prices.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In Seattle, they raised minimum wage, I think, and I was reading an article this last summer that the restaurant industry lost 700 jobs in Seattle, and I think it increased 2,000 jobs in the rest of the state. Mm-hmm. Are those numbers good, and do you see the same thing happening here in Oregon?
Mr. Chair, I think that obviously there are multiple studies of what's happened in Washington, because I believe the city of SeaTac did the same thing. We do think those are solid studies. I can't speak, I guess, categorically, but there are some that are good, and I would be happy to get those to you. We would expect if you raise the wage in Oregon, we'll see similar things happening.
Representative Kinnemer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment in this regard. I've been receiving emails from home care workers mm-hmm. on my legislative account. And they're talking about they currently make $11 an hour. And if the minimum wage is increased, they expect that they need to be increased appropriately. And I guess that seems to me to be the way I understand the way economics will work, is there will be more money spent. On the other hand, all the costs will go up. And in my view, what that means is the costs of most basic elements are going to go up, particularly food. And this will have an adverse effect on those who are in the lower pay ranges. So it's an interesting argument how we can go back and forth, that there's money spent in the economy. Yes, there'll be more money spent. That's sort of good. On the other hand, if we're not careful, the inflation eats it up. And if we're not careful, the inflation more than eats it up. And that would be my concern.
And Mr. Chair, we haven't talked about this today in particular, but that isn't the lower wage worker, not the minimum wage worker, is another aspect that will create problems, I think, when you look at the wage compression that occurs just below the low wage, when people in the $11 to $13 an hour range are suddenly making a minimum wage. They won't want to be making minimum wage. And that tends to push up the entire pay scale.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to share with you, in 1965, I made $1.25 an hour minimum wage. If you compute that in a calculator today, it's $9.42, and we're currently at $9.25. So it's pretty close. The other thing is, in 1970, when I was pulling green chain, working my way through college, the near green chain, I made $3.74 an hour. Well, that particular job today, if we had it, would be $22.88 an hour. We've killed that industry. We've killed that industry. We've gone toward a service, commercial, retail economy which in turn has dropped the living wage in my whole area down. We took away the $22.88 an hour worker, and we replaced it with a $9.25 per hour worker. This is what tourism does to you. This is what services does to you. This is what retail does to you, and this is what commercial does to you. How many people actually make $22.88 an hour in retail? Not many. So I just want people to be aware of what we have done as a state, because we were geared up to make sure that we had an economy. And when you hear of all these things for tourism or whatever about these great jobs, we need to ask ourselves, are they that great of a job? Because if it's a minimum wage job, then it probably isn't good for your economy. So I just want people to be aware of that.
Mr. Chairman, just a comment to Representative Escobar.
I'll let Representative Evans go first. He's been waiting.
Sorry.
First of all, I thank you for testimony. I thank everybody that's here. I wish I was smart enough to tell you what the best answer was. I'm still trying to take all sides in. The thing that is on my mind, though, as we listen to these things, from the end of session till today, there's a few things that have changed globally. One of which, I apologize for my naivete, but I was raised where my dad was a small businessman, his dad was a dairyman. We were all in this together. And over the summer, Pfizer, though it's not the only one, Pfizer got some attention because they're now moving their headquarters and becoming an Irish company, which is good for Ireland, but not so good for us. And still going to benefit from all the things they would benefit from, except they don't have to pay the taxes that they were going to. My concern is that we recognize that there are good and solid businesses trying to find a way to make this work in Oregon, that there are good and hardworking folks on the factory floor trying to find a way to make the economy work, and that we find a way to recognize that we have to come up with some methodology to help the middle class be vibrant again and find some way to make the economics work in this 21st century. I'm not saying I know the answer, but I am saying minimum wage is a part of the answer. Transportation may be part of the answer. Mm-hmm. We can't get into an us versus them, and we also, I think, have to recognize that the Pfizers of the world are not helping a particular side of the argument, because that type of activity frustrates those of us trying to find partners on the other side.
Representative Kinnemer, your comment.
Thank you. Just a comment I wanted to note. I have Representative Escobar beat in 58. In 7th grade, I made 95 cents an hour.
See, there is overpayment minimum wage.
Can we have that stricken from the record, please? Actually, that might have been true when I was in 7th grade. I got reprimanded for doing poor work on the latrines.
Thank you. I appreciate all the comments, and, you know, I do go back, though, you know, and looking at, you know, ways to, you know, help grow the middle class and help remove people from poverty. And, you know, I will note that, you know, your comments about trying to get the economy going better so, you know, it'll help take care of it. When we look at the presentation from Nick Belichick that shows over time with economies going up and down, those lower level, low wage jobs or those even median wage jobs have not risen.
Right.
Over these economies going up and down. So, you know, getting the economy, you know, in a robust scenario hasn't solved the issue with low wages, according to that graph anyway. You know, it hasn't automatically been a result of higher wages.
So, Mr. Chair, what I would say to that is the minimum wage, doesn't help people that are unemployed. But I do remember several summers ago when the economy was booming, a situation where you couldn't buy an employee in a low-wage job for love or money because there were so many of them. I remember driving up to a gas station, you know, just north on I-5, where they were offering 401k plans for gas station attendants just to get a gas station attendant. And you know, those aren't the median wage jobs you're talking about. But I do think, you know, when we're talking about helping people out of poverty, we're looking particularly at the unemployed. And that's the kind of economy that's going to help the unemployed, especially, you know, if you're doing a 401k gas station.
Yeah. Well, it's just not reflected in the wages, whether it's median wage or low wages.
Sure.
Yeah.
But I do think you're looking at what I think you really need to look at, or we all need to look at, is the unemployed.
Mm-hmm.
And start there.
Okay. Sorry. You've been waiting patiently.
That's all
if you'd
right.
introduce yourself, please.
Good morning, Chair Holvey and Committee. My name is Malia McCarger, and I'm an Oregon Farm Bureau member. But I'm also, most importantly, a fourth-generation farmer to own and operate Pyramine Farms just north of here in Jervis. Along with my brother, we manage 1,000 acres. We are proud grower-owners of two cooperatives here in Salem, Norpac Foods and Oregon Cherry Growers. We have grown broccoli, beans, corn, cauliflower for Norpac for 45 years, of Norpac's 91 years. We've been in business with Oregon Cherry Growers, growing sweet cherries for all of the 84 years they've been an organization. We'd like to see this continue. Raising minimum wage will adversely affect this opportunity. Two of these crops, broccoli and cherries, are labor intensive. They're both hand harvested. Cherries could currently move to machine harvest if necessary, if the price continues to rise. Broccoli, on the other hand, can't, at least as of now. It's a crop that hasn't seen much research and development put into it over the years throughout the country. And that history, you can go back to the picket lines of in California and UC Davis in 1968 and Cesar Chavez. It's a very interesting story. And since then, the federal government hasn't put any research and development into mechanizing other parts of agriculture. Because of that, farmers are now scrambling for several years to create their own models here in the valley to build a machine to be able to hand harvest or to machine harvest broccoli. But the holdup is in the development of the actual plant itself. So there's things that take time, and we don't have time right now to wait. These things need to be developed, I start to get a little, you know, emotional about this because, you know, as a family farm, it's very difficult to see your how this will impact you, and it's difficult when you do something you love to see it challenged. So I apologize. Anyway, so I'll get back on track here. I wrote this down so I could read it, so I wouldn't get all flustered. The need to develop machine harvested broccoli has been driven by the lack of labor in agriculture, combined with competing crops like blueberries, which are paid a piece rate rather than hourly. This past summer, 3 days into broccoli harvest, I had already had to negotiate wages with the crew from our labor contractor, offering a bonus incentive if they'd stay all season. They heard that crews picking blueberries were making anywhere from $40 to $100 an hour. And that's a market that allowed farmers to pay that price. But quickly, that fell out, and those farmers went to picking the rest of the blueberry crop this year by machine. We went from fighting for labor in 2 weeks to having plenty of it temporarily. This isn't an option for broccoli, though. We can't just jump to a machine if the labor disappears. We began using a labor contractor in 2012 after we struggled to keep a crew all summer for some broccoli harvest. Prior to that, on average, it cost us about $300 an acre to harvest broccoli. This is just to harvest it. This isn't hauling it. This isn't growing it. Just to harvest. In 2014, it cost us $491 an acre. So we figure everything out by acres. I don't know if you ever talk to farmers much, but it's all, everything we do, it's by the acre. So in 2015, it cost us $721 an acre just to harvest the broccoli. Again, not growing it, no power, no fertilizer, just the crew to cut. This doesn't include... All right, I'm sorry, I already said that. This is a $230 increase in 1 year. We had also increases in other areas like power. Our bills went up probably
anywhere from 5 to 10%. And in a year like this where, I don't know if you noticed, but it was hot and dry in 2015, we started irrigating as early as we were allowed and irrigated all summer long, therefore almost doubling our power bills over the summer. So these are things that we can't control and are not able to absorb quite as easily as maybe some other industries can. But what we didn't see an increase in was the price per ton for broccoli paid to us. And that's not to the fault of NORPAC, because NORPAC is only able to increase the price based on what the end consumer is willing to pay. Unfortunately, we all love to pay, or nobody bats an eye at $10.99 for their favorite microbrew. But when the price of broccoli goes up to $1 a can, or a bag of frozen cauliflower goes up, we freak out and we look for the next cheapest bag of broccoli or cauliflower. So that's why we now grow hops. But again, that's another labor-intensive crop.
And that's later in the agenda.
And that's later. I'll come back for that one. But the reason our contractor had to pass on this increase over the last few years is because of the labor shortage. They're fighting with additional other contractors around the area to keep a labor pool. The labor pool is dwindling, and people see agriculture as something that they don't want to work in. It's the low-paying wages. On our farm, the only people who make minimum wage are our high school students. Everyone else is well above $13 an hour, and if we increase minimum wage, they will expect the increase as well, and I don't blame them, and I want to be able to afford to pay that increase, but I'm not sure if we can do that. And then broccoli, you will see broccoli disappear in the valley in the next 3 to 5 years, guaranteed, if minimum wage increase and there isn't a development for machine harvest. Farmers are going to more mechanization across the board. Nurseries are using spades to dig plants rather than crews to dig. Anywhere that they can mechanize, it's being done. A neighbor last night was just telling me that he's considering buying color sorters, optic sorters, for his berry machines to out in the field to sort berries rather than having high school students out there sorting berries, because he won't be able to increase or absorb the increase of minimum wage. So not only are we talking about opportunities for those who are trying to create a living wage, we're also talking about opportunities lost for our high school students, kids who are wanting to get that first job. We went away from hiring high school students about, I say 20 years ago, because I think that's about when I graduated from college. And so, but you know, recently my husband teaches at Jervis High School, and every spring he has students asking, does your wife have work for me? Does your wife have a job I can come get? So I thought, you know what? Kids want to work. Despite what we all think, kids really do want to work. So we took the opportunity, and my husband now gets to drive a tractor every summer. And no summer's off for him. And he supervises these high school students. And not only are the kids grateful and thankful for the opportunity, their parents are grateful. Every fall when I see them at registration and school board meetings and other events, they thank me for the opportunity for their students, their children to work. I won't, it'll be very difficult to justify paying a 15-year-old $13.50 an hour. Representative Esquivel, Representative Kennemore, I think you made the point that when you were, you know, your respective ages at $1.25.
But I was worth more than Representative Kennemore.
That's right. And I think a 15-year-old might say they're worth $13.50 today. I don't, you know, I guess it's all up for debate. But as a business owner, it's very difficult for me. I still want to try to provide that opportunity, but it will be very difficult to swallow that. And it'll also be very difficult to say no to those kids again. So these are some things that I'd like you to think about, and I want you to know I completely understand this. I live in a school district that's 85% free and reduced. I'm on the school board of that school district. Our farm participates and is supporters of Oregon Food Bank, of the Marion Polk Food Share, of Salem Harvest. I'm the current chair of United Way of Mid-Willamette Valley. We get what this looks like. We want to help. But I think the best way to do it is start creating other opportunities by providing skills providing funding, additional funding to provide skills so kids can get certificates in welding and start out making $35 because they have the skill to do it. I think that there's other areas to focus on, and just raising minimum wage is just putting a hole or a Band-Aid over a hole, and it's going to start bleeding somewhere else. And I think that the loss of businesses and especially in agriculture will be the first to hurt.
Thank you. We're running a little bit behind schedule. I really just have one question for the both of you, I guess. You know, given that the current status of the world is the state of Oregon has an initiative system, and we have initiatives coming to the ballot, which is nothing the legislature has done or can do anything about if we wanted to. And I think it was referenced by one of the proponents about, you know, a deal, you know, as such. What do you think the legislature should do, if anything?
Go ahead, Molly.
Boy, that's a great question. I don't think that either of the LC 239 or LC, was it 238? Was that the other? I got this task thrown at me last night. So I had to quickly. I
you know what you're talking tomorrow, about.
Right? So my homework got done. But I think that I don't think that a tiered system will work very well. And so for the legislature I guess that's better than anything. I think the Oregon Farm Bureau and many farms support the preempted system that's in place now, where it, you know, because if not, you're taking away the competitive advantage for many of us by removing that. Oregon Cherry Growers is in two different counties, the Dalles and in Salem, so Wasco County and Marion County, both, I understand, are on two different tiers, Tier 2 and Tier 3. And I think that what that'll do is create confusion for Oregon Cherry Growers and how they handle their employees and employment, and they risk losing probably employees to counties nearby where they maybe can pay more. And I'm not sure how a company would handle that. And as being a grower owner of that company, it's frustrating to have to deal with. But I'm not sure. I think funding for education, for career tech programs, and start trying to train those that are underemployed and unemployed, and provide those kinds of services to get them into opportunities where they can earn a living wage. I mean, I want to be able to hire high school kids and not have to worry about underemploying farm workers. I don't know.
Answer, Betsy.
Sure, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It sounds like from some of the previous testimony, there will be at least one ballot measure going mm-hmm. forward, no matter what. And what I would say to you is that we will have to fight that ballot measure probably. So we'll have to expend resources one way or another, regardless of what you guys do.
Okay.
But I would advise you to just sit tight.
Mm-hmm.
Do nothing.
You can come to the school board meeting tonight with me if you'd like, and we can try to work it out there.
I wish I could. Representative Barreto, did you have a...
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think actually Representative Nose kind of hit it, you know, in the last one, and he said something about why wouldn't businesses flourish here in Oregon, and when you say CTE or STEM or get people into the trades, you still need the businesses to provide the jobs for those people for the middle class wages. And so I think the question is, how do we make Oregon a business-friendly state that wants to bring business in, grow, and sustain the businesses that we have? Because that's what we need, is more jobs in those sectors, so that it's not as so that these low wage jobs, you know, aren't the majority of the jobs we have.
Representative Fredo, if you don't mind, Chair Holvey, there are, you know, a lot of the businesses that we work with, John Deere, you know, Pape Machinery, they have a shortage of mechanics. They're looking, Eggwest, they, you know, Case IH, they're looking for mechanics. They can't find welders certified. And they have had that problem for 5 years, 6 years. And even with the rest of the economy kind of improving, they still have a need. And it's because they can't find skilled, trained people for those jobs. They're there. There are jobs that are there starting at $35 an hour, but they don't have the skills to do it. And companies like Papay and John Deere are willing to pay for students essentially to go to school to get those skills and come back and work for them. So it's there. It's just trying to figure out ways to ease some of those burdens for those companies. And I think sitting down and having conversations with them and finding out what that is probably the easiest way to do it.
Yeah, I'm not in disagreement of the education. I'm just saying you need more than just that.
Right.
Thank you very much for coming this morning on short notice. And good luck at the school board meeting.
Thank you.
With that, up next, I'd like to have...
I'll take
Caitlin Baggett and Jim White. And Jim, why don't you go ahead and go first, and we'll finish up with Caitlin.
All right, great. Thank you, Chairman Holby, for the invitation, for the opportunity to talk to you all today. My name is Jim White. I'm the executive director of the Nonprofit Association of Oregon. We are the state association for nonprofits for the charitable benefit sector here in Oregon. Just a little bit of background. The charitable benefits sector here in Oregon is 17,000 organizations. Since you're dealing with employment issues today, to give you some perspective, there are over 172,000 people employed with nonprofits here in Oregon. That constitutes roughly, and Nick may disagree with me on this because he may have newer employment numbers, but that constitutes somewhere between 10 and 12% of the private employment economy, which is larger than the manufacturing sector here in Oregon. So I'm here today to talk to you about the business class of what nonprofits are thinking about the minimum wage here in Oregon. Throughout last year, NAO conducted a series of surveys and focus group discussions across the state. We invited as many nonprofit organizations as wanted to engage with us in questions about how would a change in the minimum wage affect the work that they do, both for their program participants and for their own employees. And through that survey, we had over 250 responding organizations participate in those discussions. We did the focus groups around the state, so we went out to Eugene, down to Medford, out to Central Oregon. We also participated in some initiatives that Caitlin's going to talk about here in a little bit. And through the work that we did, we came up with basically some general findings that nonprofits were talking about as they were engaging around how to change the minimum wage here in Oregon. Generally, nonprofits want living wages for their program participants and for their staff. So they are supportive of increases both as employers and based on their concern for the members of their community who struggle with low incomes. Many nonprofits proudly pay their staff well above the minimum wage that is set and have set their scales based on cost of living indexes or other key indicators. We also heard from those who participated that nonprofits are not seeking a general exemption. We're not looking, as has happened in some of the city initiatives that have happened around the country, that the business class of nonprofits were actually exempted out of this. We believe that as a business class, as a employer, an important employer, and as a group of organizations that provides a public benefit, that we value our staff deeply and we're not interested in becoming an employer of last resort. Nonprofits want to ensure minimal disruption of critical community services. So our business model is nonprofits, and when I talk about nonprofits generally, as I said, there's 17,000 different nonprofits here in Oregon. We're blessed with a huge number of organizations and people who care about their communities and who express that through the charitable benefit sector. The business models of nonprofits generally, and that's a very broad generalization, require what you could call a third-party payer system. So while some nonprofits earn some revenues by having a subsidized amount that a a person pays for that service, the nonprofit sector in general has a third-party payer pay the subsidization for that service to be granted to that individual. So to be clear, many of that third-party payment is made actually by the government at various levels. So it's done through contracts or it's done through grants. It may be done through grants by private organizations such as foundations or private individuals, private philanthropists. The general population of people who care about Oregon and who care about what nonprofits do here in Oregon. In that third-party payer system, what we need to be conscious, what I hope you all can be conscious of, is that changes in the minimum wage will then require additional revenue to be put aside for the same sets of services. So we want to make sure that there is no break in critical services to the most vulnerable. To those people who are not employed, to those people who are mentally ill, to that veteran on the street who is homeless, to those people who desperately need these services that are either charitably given to them or they are contracted through the state, the county, the cities, through a nonprofit to benefit that service class. Last two points, and this kind of goes to what Caitlin is going to cover more here, is that nonprofits generally support a regional approach to the minimum wage. The discussions we had with people with various nonprofits around the state was that using Oregon's existing economic districts and other broadly accepted data, Oregon, we believe, can develop a regional wage solution that's rational for low-paid workers that is responsive to the state's rural economies, the difference in the cost of living in rural and urban economies here in Oregon. And then lastly, and related to that, we believe that nonprofits prefer a change to the minimum wage be implemented through the legislature, that the complexities that you're going to be grappling with through this short session, and I congratulate you all for taking on this important work, we believe that the jurisdictional authority staying at the state level to decide and to be able to work through these complexities is probably the best solution. So we're looking to the legislature to try to solve this, and we're willing in any way that we think we could help to that end. So thank you.
Thank you.
We'll go. Mr. Chair.
Okay. Apparently the real chair is coming back. So he's just testified. Caitlin has not yet. I don't know if you want to take questions now or finish the panel.
I wanted to ask a question.
Mm. Representative Kinnemer.
Thank you. Sure. What would you estimate is the current percentage of a minimum wage jobs in NAO?
Chair Holvey, Representative Kinnemer. NAO is the entity. I just want to make sure that you're that
well, I'm and I may my, have this wrong. I'm not familiar
but
with your
in
organization.
The sector, I don't have a exact amount, an exact percentage of what is the percentage of minimum wage jobs. So I'm sorry, I just don't have that.
But would you estimate it's significant a majority or
that's something
very
you could come
minor.
Up with?
I think it's probably something we could come up with.
You look at that, could you look at what percentage of workers are below 1350? As well as what percentage of workers are minimum wage?
Sure. We did, in the discussions and in the surveys that we did ask for organizations to come back to us with some idea of what it would take to get to both 1350 and to 15. And we also recognize the issue of compression, that worker who might be at 1350 now, who manages a person who would be going up to 1350, their salary would likely change as well. While we're talking about such a broad business class of organizations, it's very hard to put a big number around it all. Sure. But we did ask for examples of what it would take. And in a particular organization that we talked to, they estimated that the cost to bring staff to you know, various levels, we got those estimates from them on what it would take with compression. And one of the issues that you may want to consider as you're drafting legislation would be around the benefits, the additional wraparound benefits that are given to people as part of their compensation package. So payments into 401k or 403b programs, additional health and service benefits. In other city versions of raises to the minimum wage, those have been taken into consideration as you start to look at these various levels and glide paths. So I know that in Seattle and SeaTac, they did take that into consideration for certain business classes.
Yeah. To if help you have some hard numbers,
we'll try and get you some numbers on that. Thank you. Thank you for that question.
Good morning. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good morning. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Caitlin Baggett. I'm the executive director of the North Star Civic Foundation. Thank you for the opportunity to present today on regional economic differences in Oregon and the concept of a wage policy that responds to those regional differences. It is abundantly clear that Oregon's distinct regional economies require a minimum wage solution that's more nuanced than one size fits all. Over the last 10 months, our foundation has funded research, interviews, and community listening sessions, primarily with employers and primarily in rural areas, to better understand regional differences in the economy and to dig into the reality that we've all heard, that $15 an hour might work in Portland, but that it would be a different story in many rural areas. And we do have a scintillating 40-page page-turner on our website that is available for you. Our approach is focused on understanding the right structure. Let's see if I have better luck with this than Nick. No, I don't.
Oh, can I take this? A wireless should.
You think a wireless should work?
Maybe use the rollerball.
Oh, gotcha. I get it. Very sensitive. All right, our focus has...
LR.
Well, that's a good thing. Our focus has been to understand the right structure for a minimum wage, not the right number, although the economic data that we've surfaced and analyzed does offer some guidance on that question. And our focus has also been to understand the concept of how a regional wage, regional minimum wage, or a schedule of wages that respond to regional differences in cost of living or regional economic factors, how that might work. Many states now have de facto regional wage systems because cities have set wages higher than the surrounding area. And in fact, our country as a whole has a de facto regional wage system. The wage is not the same in Idaho as it is in Oregon, and people along the border experience that. Not all people living in Idaho have moved to Oregon as a result, but we can look into that. The concept here is to see if the state of Oregon can create a system of regional wages that is more intentional and more focused on the long range than these kind of de facto systems that we're seeing with city-level wages or state-by-state changes across the country. One option is for the state to lift the law that preempts local areas from setting their own wages. That would create a kind of regional wage system. An alternative option is to use broadly accepted economic data and cost of living data as the basis for a wage solution set at the state level that could be simple, rational, better for low-paid workers in all parts of the state, and more responsive to the state's changing rural economy. The legislature can act within existing laws and existing frameworks to develop a pragmatic and compassionate and economically sound minimum wage policy separately from looking at the preemption law. Those two things don't have to be linked. I'm going to go through my slides relatively quickly, and I believe that you have them for the record. No, wrong direction. So the cost of living has been a central part of the arguments made by both of the ballot measure campaigns for why the wages need to be raised. Research from many sources paint a common picture for low-income Oregonians. It costs less to live in Douglas, Polk, or Morrow County than it does in Lane County, or in the Portland metro area, or in Hood River. Indeed, a quick look at Craigslist this week shows that a small apartment in the greater Portland area is about $1,500 a month, whereas it's $600 a month in a rural county. I've pulled out Multnomah, Deschutes, and Malheur County in this slide to show you a high cost of living area, a medium cost of living area, and a low cost of living area in the state. And those three areas will be highlighted in each slide that I show you. But we all know cost of living cannot be the sole determinant of the minimum wage. If it was, we would set wages at $100 an hour. We also need an indicator of the impact of wage increases on the economy as a whole. Both conservative and liberal economists agree that one indicator of a normal or average minimum wage is the relationship between the minimum and the median. You heard Nick earlier talking about 50% of the median. When the minimum wage is at that range, 50% or half of the median, that's average for economies around the world, and it's been the average for the state of Oregon as a whole, as Nick said, for the last 25 years. While you can hear differences in political opinion among economists on what this ratio should be, indeed, you can find economists who would say there should be no minimum wage. Political opinion is different than fact. Economists around the world descriptively see that it's average for the minimum to be half of the median. And they also see many economies where the relationship between the minimum and the median is greater than that. In Turkey and France, for instance, it is as high as 70%. And so what you see on this chart is that 50% is the bottom of this gray line, and 65% is the top. And what that shows is a range of where the minimum wage would be normal. It's not saying that it's a good thing. It's not saying that it's a direction. That it's just offering what a normal range would be. Using the scale, what you can see is that in Washington County in 2014, the minimum wage was below average for the state of Oregon as a whole, for history, and around the world. You can also see that in Clatsop County, it was kind of in the middle, or slightly above average. Mm. Not only is the current cost of living higher in some areas than others, it is also rising more quickly in some areas than others. What you see here is that between 2011 and 2014, the cost of living rose 8% a year in Multnomah County. In Deschutes County, it rose at half that rate. It was 4% a year. And in Malheur County, we saw a 2% a year increase, which is more in line with what we're seeing with CPI generally. If we project this data forward to 2002, I can go the right direction. Using the average 2.1% inflation, what we see is all I've done is moved this whole thing up 2.1% a year. We see how these numbers relate to each other, and you can put on top of that the current ballot measure proposals. So you can see how 1350 statewide would relate to both cost of living and also to this normal range for economic health. And you can also see how 15 relates to those numbers. But how big are each of these areas? In terms of the workers who would be affected, how many low-paid jobs would be affected by increasing the wages at this level? I'm just sort of breaking the state into somewhat arbitrary chunks here. What you find is that, not surprisingly, 45% of low-paid jobs in Oregon are in the Portland, Multnomah, Clackamas, Washington County area. It's the largest population center and economic driver for the state. So it's no surprise that there are so many low-paid jobs in those three counties. This is really just for illustration purposes. The rest of the graph here is not to scale. There's no denying that hardworking people struggle to make ends meet in every county in Oregon. But in the greater Portland area, we also see that the need to raise the minimum wage is urgent and immediate, and it affects nearly half of Oregon's low-paid workers. In other parts of the state, a slower path toward increasing the minimum wage may be more appropriate, both as a measure to address local poverty needs, and also as a way to protect rural economies that are still emerging from the last recession. In other states, regional wage systems have been created by default as cities have adopted higher wages than the state as a whole. Oregon has an opportunity to set wage schedules across the state in response to this basic economic data and in response to the differences in urban and rural economies with intention, a systematic approach, and a long-range view on economic growth. A regional wage policy need not be overly complex or difficult to manage, and there are several sound options for how to do it. The simplest of them would be to use the existing legal structure and economic districts that we have and set three or four on-ramps to a higher wage, recognizing that you would want a fast track in the greater Portland area, a slightly slower path perhaps in mid-sized cities, connected regional economies, and a slower path in areas where there are high levels of unemployment, a low cost of living, and a sluggish recovery from the recession. We do not have a specific proposal, but here are some of the options for how to do it. Using existing geographic areas, it could be done at city level, within UGB areas, at the county level, or at the existing economic districts that the state, where the state currently evaluates economic data, prevailing wage districts, which are made up of counties, and local workforce areas, which are also comprised of counties. Simplicity should be the rule here. 2 to 4 regions, probably understandable both by employers and by workers. And as a basic work protection, a regionalism should be chosen that workers can understand. People know what city they live in. They know what counties they live in. A simple approach should make sense in terms of explaining it to workers. And finally, if a legislative solution emerges here, offering flexibility by setting criteria for future changes.
So, Caitlin, on that specific point, setting criteria to establish what a minimum wage should be in an area, most of the data that I've seen for the state is at the county level and not at a UGB level. I mean, I know people, some people don't even know if they're inside of a UGB. So what are the, I mean, is that a, that seems like an administrative challenge.
So most of the data, the economic data that I've seen is also at the county level. I've actually not investigated whether or not there's economic data available at the UGB level, and so I can't answer that question. But no matter what region is chosen, there would be pros and cons. Mm-hmm. And the process of discovering economic data related to a metro region or a UGB is something that our state economist, that is work that can be done. I wouldn't see that as a barrier to creating a sound and simple solution.
Okay.
The economic data that can tell us what's happened historically is certainly available at the county level.
Thanks. Go ahead and continue. Oh. You got a question, Kinnamer?
No, I thought maybe she was, if she's continuing. I have a comment and question at the end.
I'm happy to take questions.
Yeah. Well, we'll just keep moving along here. We got to run a little bit behind schedule. I don't see any questions at this point, so go ahead. Are you done?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Oh, there we go. That's the question I had. Okay, there we go.
What? Now the floodgates are open.
Yeah. Just a little slow,
you shouldn't
I guess.
Have said that.
Representative Kinnamer, your comment or question?
Thank you. Yeah, I guess I wanted to go back to a comment that Mr. White made. You know, Mr. Chair, you were talking about alternatives and how do you come up with a compromise or something. Because I think a lot of us find the notion of raising the minimum wage pretty unsatisfactory and think it has a lot of harsh economic impacts.
And I'm reflecting back a couple of things, and excuse me for kind of rambling, but I think I get to a point here, and that is, yes, and I am aware of the time, is that I remember Representative Barreto was talking about Seattle. And one of the things that happened in Seattle in an article I read was that quite a number of the people reduced their hours when their wage was increased dramatically so that they would not lose benefits. And the idea that Mr. White had is that maybe you could include the benefits as wrap-up costs so they would accumulate credit towards the minimum wage. Because I've had a number of employers who have just looked me in the eye when I was at the Chamber of Commerce and said, you know, if this wage increase goes, we're dropping our health care benefit. And we're probably going to drop our retirement benefit and several other, any other benefits that we have because, and I'm thinking, well, what a shame. Those things are really good things in helping people and probably helping them more. And often on the income tax, they don't necessarily contribute to raising your wage, so you pay less taxes, so there is a double benefit there. So I wanted to more make that statement as some thinking for some people. I don't have the expertise to put together such a proposal. I'm not sure I could really support it, but it at least is, a potentially viable alternative to just hard dollar increases.
Representative Barreto, a quick comment.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would ag be maybe left out of this? I mean, the last testimony we heard, cherry crops here versus over here in this region, you know, paying different wages for harvesting. Is there a amendment or any area that we can leave ag out of this picture for the regional?
Well, so amendments are your job. And what I heard in talking with we primarily talked with low-wage employers, which included many farm owners around the state. And when we discussed with them the opportunity to have a set of regional wages, for many farmers, this represented a level of relief. Farm owners operate in the labor market just like anybody else. And so what we also heard from many farm owners was that they would prefer not to see an exemption because they are already paying wages far higher than the minimum wage. And so an exemption doesn't make a huge difference for the labor market that they're currently working in. Mm-hmm. However, having a system of wages that relates to the regional economies where most farms in the state are located would put them on a slower path toward a higher wage. And Chair Holvey, if I could reply briefly to Representative Kennemer's question about benefits. Another thing that we heard from many business owners who would prefer to keep benefits and to not disrupt their commitments and relationships with their employees is that the most important factor in that is having a period of time where for a small business, the owner, or for a large business, their HR department could assess and understand the changes that they would need to make overall as a company to adapt to an increase in the minimum wage. That if they need to adapt overnight, they make harsh cuts, but if they have 6 or 8 months to plan for a change, they're able to make a more holistic set of choices that result in fewer cuts.
Thank you. I really appreciate your input into this, along into our work group as well, and all the research and surveying you did. It's really been good information coming back to the work group and to this committee as well. So I just wanted to thank you for your work.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
Can I make one very, very quick comment? And this
Certainly.
Is for the folks that are out here working on the group. If you can go through and calculate what the hourly benefit cost is to employers, whether it be health benefits, whether it be, you know, all of those, because sometimes I think that that's sometimes used as an issue when sometimes, especially with retirement, it's pennies, where on other things that might be dollars. So if that kind of information can also be shared, that would be helpful.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony this morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, a little bit behind schedule, committee, so I'm going to try to keep this moving. We're going to listen about brewery license privileges next. And so I would like Paul Romaine, Rob Miletus, Bill Donovan. Amanda is on here, too. And, of course, we have Jesse, who's trying to keep a low profile, from OLCC, who's here to answer any questions. At least I thought he was here. Oh, he's still there. Just so you're aware, committee, OLCC is in the room if you have questions for them. But we'll just turn this over to the panel to comment on what looks like one of our committee bills and the work group trying to come to an agreement on some language.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine with the Romaine Group, representing the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. And it's interesting, after your previous hearing on a bill that where you're trying to figure out what a solution is, what we did in this one, and actually thanks to the chair and actually a little bit to the chair, a whole bunch to the committee administrator, we brought together a lot of people that had a lot of different views and put everybody in a room, had drafts going back and forth, and actually worked out something that we literally came to agreement on. So it makes it a lot easier. The thing you have to understand is that the basic thing is you're dealing with a regulated product. It's alcohol. So there are statutes about this. It's not potato chips. It's not just the general product out there. Abuse of the product can cause problems. We regulate the market. We regulate how it's sold, all those things. What happened is about a year ago, or a year, 2 years ago, times in my mind, everything is a long time ago, we ended up with a large brewer, basically buying a small brewer in the state of Oregon, which is usually a good thing. But that brewer also had retail privileges. You could combine a winery license and a brewery license and basically let yourself in for, in effect, getting into the retail tier and getting into the retail tier in a big way. And that presented a problem, because what we don't have in Oregon, and frankly in most of the United States, is what they have in Europe, where the big brewer dominates the market. Here, you can tell, because our microbrewers do so well in this state, it's really a microbrewer-dominated market, and that's because nobody can really control the market. So what we did is try to figure out a way to make everybody whole. We didn't want to take away a privilege that somebody had actually acquired legitimately, or something they were doing legitimately, but yet put restrictions on what you could do. And what you see before you in LC-260 is the product of that effort. It basically limits a brewer from having more than three retail locations. So you couldn't, in effect, buy three different breweries, have those, and then have the satellite premises from those places and end up multiplying your retail footprint. It limits you to three. That's the maximum. Frankly, I think there's only, I think most, I don't think anybody's more than two right now, maybe one. But it's what you could do under existing law. It basically requires what the OLCC has always required, but maybe didn't have the exact authority to do, which is if you wanted to distribute somebody else's product, you needed to get a wholesaler license. So that's in this bill. And it just basically tries to put together all the different concepts that we had about what you could do with this brewery license and what you couldn't do with a brewery license, come to a consensus with the brewers, with the distillers, with everybody in the room, and go forward to you and say, this is what the brewery license should look like. We think it's going to be a model for the rest of the country, frankly, where a brewer can, in effect, be in the retail tier. We think that this will actually be something we will be able to wave to everybody else and say, look, we solved the problem without getting draconian. And we don't believe there's any real serious opposition to what we've done here, at least within the industry that's affected by the brewery license. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. We would urge you to put the bill in the hopper, and obviously as we start looking at it closer and closer, somebody will be paid to come up with some kind of weird idea that doesn't fit, but we'll deal with that at some point.
Go ahead, Rob. Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the House and Business Transportation Committee. My name is Rob Miletus. I'm the owner of Miletus Beverage, a fourth-generation, family-run business, locally owned and operated beverage distribution company servicing Oregon since 1935, right after Prohibition. I won't go into some of the history. Paul did that eloquently in regards to where we've kind of developed over the years. I would like to thank you for pulling together, though, such a broad representation of the malt beverage industry and welcoming our participation. Miletus Beverage is in full support of the work group's efforts to clarify licensing privileges for breweries, especially how they relate to distribution. The work group has worked hard to reach this consensus. Our position at Miletus Beverage has been and will continue to be about the importance of a strong three-tier system in Oregon that separates producer, distributor, and retailer of alcoholic beverages. Our three-tier system has allowed Oregon's craft beverage industry to begin, to grow, and to thrive in Oregon to the envy of other states. Why does this matter? It provides access to market for manufacturers, big and small. We provide the sales, the delivery, warehouse functions to get these perishable products to thousands of retailers across the state, something most producers can't do on their own. And when the three-tier system functions correctly, independent distributors, like ourselves, are motivated to market products that consumers want throughout the state of Oregon. We believe this legislation will strengthen the three-tier system in Oregon, and we look forward to reviewing the final language and supporting its adoption. Thank you for your time and consideration. And I will also take any questions that you might have.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Phil Donovan here on behalf of Ninkasi Brewing. Apologies from Nikos Ridge, who's been an active participant in the work group. He's out of the state today. But he wanted me to convey, first off, thank you to the chair and the committee administrator for the hard work that was put in during the interim and bringing together such a broad group. And we had brewers big and small from Portland. We had them rural from Astoria, obviously Ninkasi from Eugene. And we are we thought that it was a very thoughtful, deliberative process. We want to thank the legislature. You have created laws that have allowed the craft brewing industry to thrive and grow in Oregon. However, the current licensing types has been confusing, and it's, brewers have obtained multiple licenses. This is called stacking, and it's brought additional costs to both the state and to brewers. So our goal coming into this was to consolidate the brewery privileges into one license and eliminate the stacking, provide clarity on what the licenses are being used for, and create a little bit more efficient government here with an OLCC not having to issue so many licenses that they actually don't recoup all of their costs on. As my colleagues here have indicated, we've reached broad agreement. The brewery license legislation before you would allow brewers to maintain the following privileges. We can continue to use guest taps and sell wine and cider. We can obtain a special events license, have up to 3 retail locations, and additionally would allow brewers to obtain a full on-premise sales license to serve distilled spirits. Lastly, and perhaps most importantly, the legislation would clarify that breweries would need to get a wholesale malt beverage and wine license in order to distribute. See, as a brewery, Ninkasi strongly supports this clarification and believes that if you're distributing beer, you should have a license. So, anyways, we appreciate the time of the committee this morning. Urge its adoption. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? I just really appreciate all the participants, and for the committee's knowledge, the Wine Association was also involved in this work group and actually had some input that they were interested in, too. So I just wanted to put that on the record as well. You know, there's one little small piece of this concept that, I'm comfortable with moving ahead with, but, you know, am cautious about it as well. And that was the piece that allowed a brewer to import product from an out-of-state brewery that they owned to one retail location. I'm a little nervous about how that morphs in the future. We'll just have to keep our eyes on it if there's a problem. I'm not expecting one, so maybe my fears are misguided at this point, but I'm really happy that everybody came together and, you know, has such broad agreement, and thank OLCC for their participation throughout the process, and also the comments about the committee administrator Jan are well intended, and really she deserves a great deal of credit for all her help. So,
Mr. Chair, could I just clarify one thing? Currently under the brewery license, the brewer could import or can import today from that outside facility that they own. What this does is allow them to import to their brewery facility, mm-hmm. not to, and if they happen to have a retail establishment there, they would, that's all it allows them to do.
Right.
If they want to move it from that facility, they still need to get the wholesaler license. So it's a very limited provision that we think works for everybody. It's what Widmer does today, and we didn't want to
take it away.
Stop what anybody else was doing.
And I agree. This language and these statutes seem to me very hard to understand, very convoluted.
Very easy to understand.
And I also got to thank Chuck Taylor with Legislative Council and trying to, you know, put this language together so it makes better sense and makes it more well understood by the industry and me a little bit too. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Up next, I'm going to have a Vern Sabo.
Chair Hovey, members of the committee, for the record, Vern Sabo representing the Oregon Chiropractic Association. I'll make my comments brief. Bill concept is regarding the continued problem of unlawful forcing of injured workers to treat with a particular clinic, usually an occupational medical clinic or urgent care clinic, in direct violation of current statute, which states that the injured worker gets to choose their health care provider, not their employer or anyone else. And also misinformation from other parties, many times just simply not knowing what the workers' comp laws are. The fix, the proposal is to direct DCBS to produce a form or use existing forms which would include a disclosure statement clearly disclosing to the injured worker their treatment rights that says something along the lines that my employer has informed me that I can see the health care provider of my choice. My employer cannot choose my health care provider. If mandatory drug testing is required, after that testing is performed, I can then go on to see the health care provider of my choice, my family physician, family chiropractor, naturopath, whatever. And that there's a signature line. The employer signs off on it. The worker signs off on it. And of late, there is a suggestion that we utilize existing forms, the report of job injury or illness, also known as Form 801, and just simply insert that disclosure language and signature lines into that form, which is a very good idea. The other is just insert it into Form 827, which is known as the worker and health care provider report. So the hope is to inform those individuals who don't know what a worker's rights are, inform the worker, and to address those who knowingly and unlawfully force injured workers to particular clinics or providers. That completes my testimony. I'd be willing to answer any questions.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And committee, if you recall, I think we had an informational meeting in November on this subject matter. Mm-hmm. And as yet, I know that MLAC will perhaps be taking a look at this measure ahead of the February session, hopefully. So we'll get some feedback from them on this measure, too. So we're not quite done with this measure yet, but it is going to be one of our committee bills if the committee will approve it. Any questions?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
God bless.
Up next is Jim in here? Dino?
This is easy. God bless again.
Thank you. Are you larger to me?
Okay.
Can we skip to the work session?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So with that, I'm going to close the informational meeting and open a work session for the purpose of introduction of committee bills. Committee, we have three LCs. LC 258 relates to the minimum wage. LC 260 relates to the brewery licensees that you heard about, and the third one, LC 276, relates to the medical services provided to injured workers. So that will be our starting point for these measures for introduction and further discussion in this committee.
Chair Holvey, I move that the following three legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills: LC 258, dated January 6, 2016, LC 260, dated January 8, 2016, and LC 276, dated January 7, 2016. And I move they be introduced as committee bills.
Representative Barton moves that LC 258, relating to minimum wage, LC 260, relating to brewery licensees, and LC 276, related to medical services provided to injured workers, LC 258, dated January 6, 2016, LC 260, dated January 8, 2016, and LC 276, dated January 7, 2016. Is there any discussion on introducing these as committee bills?
Just a clarification.
Clarification.
And the clarification means that introducing these bills don't necessarily mean that we support them or whatever we're tied. It's just introduction.
Thank you. voting in the affirmative does not mean that you support or oppose any of these particular concepts. This is, as you know, a formality for us to have a democratic process in discussing and either rejecting or approving these measures.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Cameron?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. Just to follow up, I think we've had a tradition of introducing these as a courtesy. It does not necessarily imply support. And in fact, I would think, particularly on minimum wage, some of us are going to have some very difficult moments with that bill.
Yes.
But nonetheless,
I think all of us will.
And that's probably more accurate. Thank you.
All right. So is there any objection to introducing these as committee bills? Seeing none, the measures are introduced as committee bills. I'll close the work session and reopen the informational meeting on. And we're going to have a quick review of a description of a measure that will likely come to us from Representative Peluso. If you'd like to come up and describe the measure that you're introducing.
Yes, I would. Thank you, Chair Holvey. For the record, my name is Carla Peluso, representative for House District 50, Gresham, and a little bit of Southeast Portland. Chair Holvey, I am very much appreciated being here today to provide a brief overview of LC 164, Employment Protections for Familial Status or Caregiver Status. LC 164 may seem familiar to members of the committee. This concept was before you all during the long session as House Bill 2685. LC 164 is designed to ensure that parents and caregivers are not discriminated against at work for their familial responsibility outside of the workforce, of the workplace. Family responsibilities discrimination or caregiver discrimination is discrimination in the workplace based on an employee's responsibility real or perceived, to care for family members. Employers may discriminate based on family responsibilities when they deny employment or promotions, pay less, or otherwise take negative employment action against an employee because of the employee's family's responsibilities. So what does caregiver discrimination actually look like? Perhaps passing over highly qualified mothers for higher or promotion in favor of less qualified fathers or women without children. Denying flexibility to employees who want it for childcare reasons while allowing flexibility to employees for non-family reasons. Firing or demoting employees whose spouses or elderly parents become disabled for fear of increased absenteeism or higher health insurance premiums. Harassing or penalizing workers who take time off to care for their aging parents or sick spouses or partners. And retaliation by cutting hours for an employee requesting a flexible schedule. Pregnant women, mothers and fathers of young children, and employees with aging parents or sick spouses or partners may encounter family responsibilities discrimination. One-third of all American families in the workforce, parents, believe they have been passed over for a promotion, raise, or new job because of the need for a flexible schedule. In addition, more and more Americans are shouldering elderly and family care responsibilities. About half of the U.S. workforce expects to be providing elder care in the coming 5 years. Most family caregivers are women at 66% and spend as much as 20 additional unpaid hours outside of work caring for family. Elder care responsibilities fall disproportionately not only on women, but also on low-wage workers. Families living below the federal poverty level are more than twice as likely as higher income workers to provide more than 30 hours a week of unpaid assistance to family members. These trends underscore the need for solutions to ensure that workers with caregiving responsibility receive equal employment opportunity and are protected from discrimination in the workplace. That is exactly what LC 164 will do. In fact, currently there are 7 different local jurisdictions around the state that have protections like LC 164 already in place. Thank you, Chair Holvey and members of the committee, for the opportunity to brief you on LC 164. My aim this morning was to keep my comments intentionally brief as I look forward to expanding on this policy at a future public hearing. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. I appreciate you giving us a heads up about the subject matter and the potential that this would come to our committee. I think members will pay attention to it, and now that we have a little preview of what it is, I appreciate you bringing it to us early.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Committee, I also have one other bill that I have. I'm going to just speak from the dais that will be probably coming to this committee as well, and it was a bill that had contemplated making a committee bill, but it comes from the Construction Contractors Board, and the bill basically removes a sunset that was going to happen in 2017. It would cancel the dispute resolution process that's currently in place for the Construction Contractors Board and return it to the original contested case process. The CCB has asked that sunset be removed and that they be able to continue the dispute resolution process that they have now. There hasn't been any, at least to date, huge issues with this. It seems to have been working very well for the CCB. It does not, as far as I know, take away the rights of consumers or the contractors to go to court for a decision as well, if they're not in agreement with the dispute process conclusion. So with that, that's LC 201, I'm going to try to make sure people have it so they can take a look at it. I'm already distributing it ahead of the introduction to make sure that it's in order and doesn't do much more than just change the process. So. Or remove the sunset. So I can't remember how long this process has been in place. I think it's been since 2011. that this dispute resolution process has been in place instead of the contested case process. So with that, look forward to some more discussion about that. And that's sort of the primer. There was no other members that had wanted to do a preview of concepts coming to this committee. So I think that just about concludes our work.
Get out early.
Jan?
Talk more about the minimum wage.
We can do that tomorrow.
We are. We could, but we won't.
Could have asked Chair Holby. Chair Holby, on that note.
What's happening?
I do want to apologize. Tomorrow night, I'm not going to be able to be at the added hearing. When I schedule the week, I have a night class that I teach on Tuesdays and Thursdays. I couldn't shuffle that around. So I will review the tape afterwards.
We'll consider that an excused absence.
I'm going to try to get him here part of it, but
okay.
Do we have any plans for tomorrow?
So
anything we need to discuss?
Tomorrow night we will be hearing the minimum wage concepts.
What they're saying is it's difficult.
Not that what I say is all that important, but I do want you to be aware that tomorrow night at 6 o'clock we will be having a public hearing on minimum wage process to hear from the public. There is a tremendous amount of people going to be coming. I think, did we pick a time certain, 9 o'clock?
8:30 is what I heard last.
Oh, 8:30. That we're going to try to be done by 8:30.
Seriously. Commendable.
Well,
unlikely.
I'm afraid that we won't hear all the testimony that people will, yeah. There'll be much more, so we'll have to pick that back up in the future probably. We were kind of toying around with, are we going to end at 9 o'clock or 8:30? This is a joint public hearing with the Senate. They have asked that we not ask questions of the presenters from the dais. Because we have so many people to listen to, and the public hearing is for hearing what people think about raising the minimum wage in Oregon. So
okay.
I hope that doesn't, you know, I know we all like to ask questions and get follow-up, but maybe we can direct some follow-up questions to our committee administrator and see if we can find the answers to it later. So with that,
I'm going to have a hard time with that, because I just think sometimes it's hard to understand what people are saying, and you need to ask questions to understand what is.
I understand. I'm in the same boat.
I fear it gets out of control too, but I think it's an essential part of communication.
It is, but it's also an essential part of the process to hear from the public.
Yep.
And
but you need to hear what they're saying.
And when we have so many signed up, it's important for us to hear it, and we can follow up with questions, hopefully, individually. I have to negotiate these things with my Senate counterpart. I may make one more appeal to allow a question or two, but I'm not certain I'm going to be successful in getting that approved. So with that, thank you very much and for your attendance today, and I will close the House Interim Committee on Business and Labor for Wednesday, January 13th, and adjourn.